So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to review, man.
I disgraced my race. I disgraced my family. And I disgraced myself. But you know what, Brock? I came to a point in my life, Vesimato. I came to a point where it was do or die, Holmes. I had to make a decision. Do or die. And you know what I said? I did. Because I'm here right now. Day by day, by the grace of God, I have earned my way back into this ring, man. Day by day, by the grace of God, I have earned the respect of my kids again. Day by day, I have earned my life back. And see, Holmes, when I stand across you and I see that across your waist, you know what that symbolizes for me, Ese? That symbolizes for me, I'm sorry. That's my way of telling my family, I'm sorry. That's my way of telling my kids, I'm going to provide a better way of life for them. I'm going to get the bikes that they wanted. I'm going to give them a better education. That's my new addiction, Holmes. See, when I step into this ring, yeah, bro, I am addicted. I'm addicted to the high that I get from them. I'm addicted to the high that I get when I go home and I tell my family, hey, I'm doing it. I'm addicted to the satisfaction that I get to tell everybody like you that didn't believe in me, you can stick it up your ass. I'm addicted to the do or die feeling, Holmes, that I'm gonna have this Sunday night at No Way Out, because you know as well as I do, Holmes, oh, what a high it is when we're in here, brother. See, but the difference between me and you, bro, is that I'm an addict and I'll do anything and run over anybody that it's gonna take to get that around my waist and get my high and No Way Out and become the WWE champion.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting. How are you doing today, Wei?
Doing very well. Doing very well.
It's Wednesday.
It's Wednesday. There's not much time left in our existence.
We only have another 11 months.
Mm-hmm. So that means how many more reviews?
50? Like 48, 48, give or take.
48. Enjoy it, guys. 48. That's it. That's the end.
This is the final countdown. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to be the biggest letdown? I don't want to say letdown, that the world doesn't end. But this is like the new version of Y2K.
It absolutely is.
It's going to be the same thing. I'm waiting for all the stupid gimmicks that come out of people to avoid the end of the world.
Well, I think
shelters and shit like that.
If I remember properly, the big winner to come out of the whole Y2K thing was bottled water. Bottled water was people were stocking up on the stuff, and ever since then, it's like bottled water is staple in everybody's fridge, restaurants, whatever. And I don't know what's gonna happen with this.
It's one of the brilliant marketing ideas of convincing people that bottled water is this significantly superior form of water, when it is simply bottled at like these watering like plants in the middle of nowhere. I mean, a lot of them aren't even like really filtered.
What? They're not?
Look at where they're bottled from.
They're not filtered.
I saw a whole episode on this.
What do you mean they're not filtered?
I might be taking liberties on that. I'm sure they're filtered, but there's not a gigantic difference between what's coming out of your tap. In fact, some people actually believe it's safer to drink from your tap than bottled water.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah, you don't get fluoride either in your bottled water.
That's true.
That's all I really know about the
I had to do more research on this before, but I think that I think I'm right here. I just don't have my facts in line.
Well, I can't see really what the big winner will be for this year. What more can you do?
I think it's going to be some takeoff on those gravity bracelets, something that will make you immune to death, something that will give you good something. That will give you good karma.
Okay, but if there's no world to live on, if I don't know exactly how the world
there might be a select few. There'll be like a Noah's Ark of those that will be saved. And if you want to be saved, like it's going to be crazy religious.
So we should invest in boats. Boats will be the big winner.
Because how would the world end? Would you flood it?
No, I'm thinking earthquakes, worldwide. In fact, my brother was telling me the other day, my brother lives in Shanghai, and he's telling me how over in Japan, there's a huge fear right now that another major earthquake will hit sometime in the next year. And perhaps this has something to do with that. Earthquakes. They suck.
They are terrible. And it's they're very loud.
Are they?
Earthquakes.
They must be. The natural disasters.
You've got to give credit to people who a natural disaster occurs, and then you have people with this natural fear as a result of it, and you're going to expound on that fear.
Oh yeah, that's great. You got to make money
after 9/11. Look at what happened. Do you know how like the security like industry went just through the roof, like their stocks and stuff, because everyone was panicked.
The war industry, the weapons industry probably went through
massive.
Yeah. So how can we capitalize on this fear as podcasters, as wrestling journalists?
Well, if you download this show every week, each week we're going to drop hints of how you can save yourself.
We'll give you ideas, yes.
Yes.
All right.
And if you piece it all together, you will live to see next year's Royal Rumble.
Oh, yeah. That's right. We may have seen our last Royal Rumble.
Let's chat about No Way Out.
Okay.
From San Francisco, California, Sunday, February the 15th of 2004, at the Cow Palace, the one and only WWF pay-per-view that has taken place at the Cow Palace, which used to be the home of the Roy Shire promotion, and then WCW would frequently have their Super Brawl events from the Cow Palace, a very, very famous wrestling arena.
Is that still around?
The Cow Palace, I believe, has been demolished.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Why did they call it the Cow Palace? You know?
I'm sure it had something to do with cows. You should search that.
Yeah, I'm going to do that right now.
I like arenas that have distinct names versus just random brand arena.
I do, too. I mean, it looks like it's still around. I don't think it's been demolished.
Maybe it's been closed down?
Recent developments in the spring of 08, blah, blah, blah. Starting in the 2013 season, the Cow Palace will be the home of the ECHL San Francisco Bulls.
Because I was of the impression that kind of like the Oracle Arena in Oakland had kind of replaced it. But maybe not.
Looks like it's still a minor league arena.
Okay, so it's still kicking around.
Man, it's been around since 1941.
Wow.
It was around during World War II. That's insane. So the idea behind the arena was originally conceived as a result of the popularity of the Livestock Pavilion in the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition. Newspaper records show that the name Cow Palace was used as early as 1935. One story for how the current name came about tells of a newspaper editorial that wondered aloud, why, when people are starving, should money be spent on a palace for cows? Thus, the Cow Palace was born. That's a great story. It's like, you want to criticize us? Well, fuck you.
That's awesome. That's a great story.
Yeah, that's good.
This was a show way that I found in my storage on VHS.
Damn, how often do you go in there, into your storage?
Well, fairly often, to be honest, if it's in a certain time period where I know I have the tape. Others I have to go to other means to find.
And how long does it take you to find these
tapes?
Sometimes
it can be trying. It can be really annoying because the way my storage is set up, it's that it's just like these columns of boxes.
Uh-huh.
And I've got my tapes on like one side.
You know, you're supposed to store VHS tapes vertically.
They are vertical.
They are vertical.
Yep, they are
nice.
Vertical.
Okay.
So that's good. And when I first put them all in here, I did put them like in somewhat of an order, so that I'd be able to find them because they are labeled, as you know.
There are people that often transfer their VHS tapes to DVD, but I guess for you, there's no point.
That's my girlfriend keeps saying I should do, but I was like, that is a significant undertaking on my part,
and
probably a smart one to do, to be honest, it into a digital format.
But there is absolutely no point for you to do that with these tapes, because you can get all these in DVD already.
That's true.
Or online.
Well, I would not go out and buy anything.
Yeah, but for you to waste that time and effort to transfer all these tapes to DVD at worst quality... That should be worth the price of the DVD itself.
I could never fathom going out and buying any wrestling
you can't,
DVDs.
You can't fathom going on eBay and bidding for a collection.
No, I'm done with that. I seriously, if there was a wrestling DVD for $15, I don't think I could buy it now. I have bought one wrestling DVD in like the last 5 years, and it was the Chris Jericho DVD because WWE didn't send us it, and I really wanted to see it, so I spent the $25.
But like I said, I don't see a point for you to transfer.
I'm fine with it.
And DVDs are going out anyway.
Yeah, well, these VHS tapes are not going to last the test of time.
You never know.
No, I do know. They
they won't.
It's not a very likely scenario. But my point in all this is that I turned it on, and I recorded Sunday Night Heat.
Oh, did you?
Remember that show?
Yes, I do.
And it featured a 6-man tag.
Hmm.
With Michael Cole and Taz on commentary. Listen to this one, okay? Tajiri, Sakota, and Akio, mm-hmm. Jimmy Yang, taking on Ultimo Dragon, Billy Kidman, and Paul London.
Wow. Cool.
This was better than half the stuff on the pay-per-view.
Yeah, that's great.
Referee was Jimmy Corderas, and they were promoting how the main event of WrestleMania will be determined tonight. And this was like 2 years into the brand split, and we talk about this every year, but it's one of my pet peeves of where the Royal Rumble is, to me, not as significant as it was in the past. It's still a fun show to watch,
mm-hmm.
but it's like you're competing for a mid-card match. If you fail to win the Royal Rumble, you get an opportunity at the next month's pay-per-view. Maybe even on TV in some battle royal to go to WrestleMania. Before it used to be, this is your one chance to headline WrestleMania. You're either the champion or you win the Royal Rumble.
Mm-hmm.
Two chances. Now, you have two champions. You have two challengers. You have the Rumble. You have the chamber match, which features up to 12 people in these chamber matches with two on each in each match. It just seems it's somewhat diluted.
No,
this was the beginning of this.
Absolutely, absolutely. But you can look at that as a bigger problem of the brand extension itself and the fact that you have two champions. But you can look on the other side and say, well, if we didn't have this brand extension, if we didn't have two champions, what would we be losing that we have right now? You would lose perhaps the buy rate of you know, the second pay-per-view, this February pay-per-view, without huge stakes added to it. You your house show schedule would probably not be as, you know, significant with only one touring champion.
I don't know if that's necessarily the case. Like right now, for instance, does anybody view, if you were to say CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, they are the two respective champions. Mm-hmm. Are they the two top stars in the company right now?
No.
You can make the argument for Punk, but no one thinks of Daniel Bryan in that regard. Nor do I think that anyone is going to a SmackDown house show because Daniel Bryan is defending the world title.
But the fact that a champion is on the show certainly adds something. The fact that you could advertise a title match certainly adds a whole lot to a house show.
A lot of the time, they don't even announce matches for house shows. It's just simply, come see Daniel Bryan, Big Show, and Randy Orton.
Right. See, but let's say you had a house show coming into town. You had a Raw house show one week. You had a Raw house show one time of the year with a championship match. Next time a SmackDown house show comes with no champion, are you willing to go to that SmackDown house show?
I don't think there's that big a difference. I don't think that people would not go just because there is not a quote-unquote champion on the show. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion.
Okay. I don't think so either, but I feel like it does add something. And anyway, this is it's a different argument.
The crowd was... They had the lights down here as people were still filing in. A real good match here with these six. Tajiri went for a cover after a double team to Kidman, but Corderis did not see the tag, sends him back, and they continue the heat on Kidman, who was just selling throughout the match. Tajiri attacks Ultimo Dragon and then London as well with a triple sit-out drop kick by the heels to Kidman. Akio misses with a spinning heel kick and takes a drop kick from Kidman, and this allows Kidman to make the hot tag to Ultimo Dragon, who hits a quebrada to Tajiri, and then a handspring back elbow by Tajiri. Akio then hip tosses Paul London over the top rope to the floor. Kidman then comes from behind, clotheslines Akio to the floor. Dragon goes for his finish here, but gets caught by Sakota, and then gets kicked to the back of the head, and Tajiri pins Dragon 5.5 minutes, and there were about 100 mentions of Bill Goldberg attending No Way Out tonight.
Mm-hmm.
He was the giant selling point on Sunday Night Heat. Bill Goldberg will be here tonight from Raw.
Never mind that you have a world title on the line, and perhaps one man winning his very first title in his long career for the first time.
Oh. Well, they did, in fairness, mention the main event a few times, but Bill Goldberg was front and center, and this extended into the pay-per-view.
Mm.
So the show starts. We get Sable and Tori Wilson coming out cold to start the show before the even opening video of the pay-per-view to promote their new edition of Playboy with both of them in it. And Sable says they want to say, "Hello, San Francisco. We have enjoyed the sights, and now it's your turn to enjoy us."
Huh. Wow.
What does that mean?
Enjoy our naked bodies in the issue of Playboy that's on sale today.
Tori says there is nothing the SmackDown stars won't do to entertain, and Sable says there isn't anything her and Tori won't do.
Jesus, I've seen those Playboy pictures, and like they're kind of awkward, to be honest. Like they're like, you can clearly tell that these two, they don't care at all for each other. It's just like, okay, I am going to
lick your face.
Yeah, it was very awkward. Anyway, and I find Playboy photos to be kind of awkward anyway. They're like heavily airbrushed, and they're always in very awkward positions. You know, these women, not like they don't look comfortable. They're just like,
I like the photo shoots where it's as if they are just going about everyday activities and just happen to be naked. Christy Hemmings were the best, where she was like walking down the red carpet at a movie premiere, and here are my tits. What's going on, everybody? We're going to watch a movie tonight. Look. Oh, I'm naked. Yeah, I do that. I do that sometimes.
Well, that happens. That does happen, actually.
Some people walk around naked.
No, I mean like Tara Reid or something. Didn't she have
Tori Wilson was, remember? She was reading Raw magazine in the back of a limo. It's naked.
Yeah, I don't remember that particular one. But, well, it's amazing how these situations happen.
So, the fans all enjoyed Tori and Sable, and then were curious what their limits were, which apparently there were none. And she says, "Welcome to No Way Out." And they leave holding hands.
Oh, it's so forced. And you know what? Desperate and cheap. Come on. I don't buy it.
God damn.
I need passion.
Lesbians. Let's tease lesbian. Love.
Fuck.
Well, this was a shitty start to the show. Very shitty start.
Let's give some context to this episode of this pay-per-view.
One second. Before we move off of Sable and Tori Wilson, let's rewind to how these two were feuding for the whole year. I remember this being really weird at the time because Sable returned to confront Tori about how I'm the original diva and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And they had all these weird sexual tension between the two for like all year where Tori and Sable, they would like... They were feuding, but they'd make out with each other. And then all of a sudden, maybe it does make actually a lot of sense how it led to this, where they made amends and decided, let's get photographed naked together.
Yeah, okay.
Let people enjoy us.
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. I can't get into that mindset.
Someone thought of it. And then the show actually starts with the video on Brock Lesnar being champion and saying he'll maybe take his time and have fun before the real challenge with Bill Goldberg.
Yeah.
And then they focus on Eddie Guerrero and fighting for the title. Lesnar says in this video, it's sad he's fought all those demons, but now he faces the biggest demon of all.
Hmm. Now, of course...
Good sound bites in this video,
yeah,
I thought.
Of course, this was Lesnar and... Goldberg's last month pretty much in the company, industry.
It was known Goldberg's contract was up and he'd be done, but at this point I don't think they knew Lesnar was leaving. Actually, I'm like 98% sure they did not know at this point. It was only a few weeks before Mania. It would have been right after this, I think, that they found out, shit, Lesnar's leaving, because I don't think they would have gone in that direction with Lesnar and Goldberg had they known both were leaving the next day instead of just Goldberg.
Wow.
So that kicks off the show, and we go to our first match of the night. Rikishi and Scotty Too Hotty, the tag team champions. Memorable tag team champions. Remember the Scotty Too Hotty Rikishi run?
Oh, yeah. No, I don't. You know, this team feels like it's missing something without Grandmaster Sexay. It's not a tandem without Grandmaster Sexay.
It's like a demolition without Axe.
Yes, sure.
Just crush and smash. This wasn't the same. Taking on the Basham Brothers and Shaniqua.
Shaniqua's in this.
Handicap, intergender, tag title match. Confused?
Yeah. This was some lame Russo-type booking here. If Shaniqua wins, they don't even know who's going to be the champion. They will apply the demolition rule, I suppose.
Yep, brought up the Freebirds, asking, what will Paul Heyman do? Paul Heyman was the general manager at this point on SmackDown. And we should, for those that maybe were not watching at the time, this was a SmackDown-only pay-per-view when they had the brand-specific pay-per-view. So this was all SmackDown.
And thus the controversy with Bill Goldberg attending from
Yes,
Raw.
Yes. It's we could call this a SmackDown Super Show.
No, you couldn't. Shaniqua, of course, portrayed by Linda Miles, winner of Tough Enough 2.
Not one of the memorable winners of Tough Enough. Not that there have been really any memorable winners of Tough Enough.
Morrison.
I guess John Morrison. Let's go, Maven and Nydia.
Dude, I don't even remember the name of the guy that won the last one. What's his name? The meth guy.
Andy Levine.
Oh, God.
I don't think he will be a memorable
What's going on with him?
Arian Andrews is going to be the default winner of that season. She made it to TV. She's going to be a big star.
Andy Levine. Okay, yeah. So,
and we had Jackie Gayden, Linda Miles.
Yep.
Matt Capitelli and John Morrison, those two had the potential, I think, to be the... Had Matt Capitelli, he unfortunately got brain cancer, he had, to me, a ton of promise, a lot of upside.
Yeah.
And then Tough Enough 4 was
Miz.
Pewter.
Oh, not Miz. Yeah,
Pewter, but Miz was there as well. Miz will be the standout from that season.
Yeah. That's it. Chris Nowinski. Maybe that. And Josh Matthews.
Josh Matthews.
There you go.
He might have been the most consistently. He's probably made, second to Morrison, the most money, I would say. He's been under contract for 11 years.
You could be right. Could be right.
So,
but anyway, so they bring up Linda Miles and give her.
She was terrible, guys. Well, like, this was. She was as bad as that woman, Rocka Khan or Rosa Mendez.
No. Rocka Khan never had to do this.
Rocka Khan had almost the exact same gimmick as Shaniqua's. It's like, kind of like dominatrix.
Well, at least they never made her. I just remember one of these pay-per-views from this era that we reviewed featuring one of the most awkward backstage skits.
Remember this.
Shaniqua and the Bashams doing some type
this
of
is where,
slave
did,
thing.
Didn't she, oh, yeah, that. But wasn't that the same pay-per-view where... Or some show where she took the clothesline from hell, and they explained that her chest had gotten swollen, and as a result had new boobs.
Yes. Oh, God. Anyway, so they bring her up, they give her this gimmick, and also perhaps the most stereotypical name ever for a black woman, Shaniqua. Shaniqua. If you Google Shaniqua... You come up with you get an Urban Dictionary definition for, I don't know, it's like a something like a borderline racist term for a black woman from the ghetto, and this is what we will name our character, Shaniqua.
In fairness, she was teaming with two white guys named Doug and Danny, very stereotypical white men.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yeah. Rikishi, though, that's an international name.
That's a completely different, well, that's like a Japanese.
Rakasha. And Scotty. Scotty applies a head scissors and nearly drops Danny on his white head early on. Rikishi, say what you will about this team. Fuck was the crowd into Rikishi, especially when they teased him getting Shaniqua and hip-tossing her. This got a huge pop. Teased the stink face, but Doug made the save. Scotty and Doug collide. Scotty goes up and goes for the worm, but gets cut off by a clothesline. And then the Bashams double-team Scotty. They tag in Shaniqua. Taz gets in a Pepper Gomez reference here.
What did he say?
He compared Pepper Gomez to Shaniqua.
Okay.
Pepper Gomez is like one of the legendary wrestlers from the San Francisco area who I believe had just passed away when this event took place. Scotty is kept in the heels corner and they keep yanking him back as he tries to make the tag to Rikishi. Shaniqua comes in, goes for a power bomb, but takes a back body drop. Rikishi finally is tagged in, attacks the Bashams. Shaniqua jumps on his back. She gets flipped over, crowd was really into it, and then he teases the bonsai drop, but the Bashams pull her away off the turnbuckle and knock him down to the mat. Scotty then takes out the Bashams on the floor, and Rikishi hits the Samoan drop to Shaniqua and the bonsai drop for the win at 8 minutes and 15 seconds. And Taz says, that can destroy a normal athlete's chest.
But not
this might have been reverse surgery. I think this was Shaniqua's final night with the company. She was she never returned after this.
Oh, I'm not very surprised.
This was her write-off.
I will have to say though, I thought this was decent. I thought they did a decent job of making Shaniqua look all right. You know, like she in fact came across like the powerhouse of this team. She's tall and muscular and she looks the part. She's actually taller than Scotty here. Which kind of helped, but a terrible gimmick and not didn't do any favors for any of the three people involved.
And she didn't seem to do herself any favors. Like she seems to be one of those names that when they come up of people who worked with her who would just nothing good to say about her. Just like athletically, I mean, she went to like Rutgers and played basketball. She was like a legit star athlete, but never took to wrestling and just...
Never took to becoming a dominatrix named Shaniqua? How?
She really dropped the ball. Coming up next, it's a personal matchup, they say. And we get a video of Jamie Noble and Nydia. Another Tough Enough winner.
Mm-hmm.
And the storyline is that they were dating. Then Jamie Noble came into money and he bought a trailer home where they got running water, regular buffets, And then tragedy struck when Tajiri sprayed black mist into the face of Nidia, blinding her. And the camera shot gets blurry as they're showing this scene of Nidia to emphasize her blindness. And Nidia ends up turning babyface and turns on Noble. And she puts her jacket,
her mink coat.
Her mink coat through a wood chipper.
Yeah.
And it leads to this match, which is Jamie Noble and Nidia in a, quote, boyfriend versus girlfriend blindfold match.
Of course, Noble is the one that is blindfolded.
Yes, only Noble is blindfolded, so he can experience what Nidia went through,
yeah.
Legitimately.
Okay. I felt this feud and the characters were so cartoonish, it was hard for me to get into it. But, yeah, it made sense.
Jamie Noble is a guy who's still with the company as a road agent.
Right.
Noble runs at Nidia and misses, so this was a lot of, like, your typical blindfold match. A lot of goofy comedy and nothing really technical about these matches. He gets slapped from the apron. He takes off the blindfold, but Charles Robinson threatens to disqualify him. Noble goes searching in the corner. He puts his hands up to her chest and almost grabs her in the boobs. But Nidia escapes the boob clutch.
Okay.
Then he gets pantsed by Nidia.
Yeah.
And we see a bulldog for a two count. Nidia counters a leg hold and sends Noble to the floor. He somehow finds his way back in as Nidia is taunting Noble, including doing the Norman Smiley, the big wiggle behind him.
Oh.
Nidia is on all fours. Noble trips over her. And there's a double leg takedown by Noble, but Nidia escapes. And then Nidia climbs to the top rope. With the ref's back turned, Noble pulls his hood up and suplexes her off the top into a sitting guillotine for the submission win at 4 minutes and 26 seconds. Mm-hmm. The dastardly heel cheats and submits a woman.
So the moral of this pay-per-view thus far, don't fuck with men. You get slapped.
And you get beat.
You get sit on and choked out. So I don't really mean that.
Well, not a good night for the women. Not at all. But some,
yeah, I mean...
Not a great match.
No, like I said, this is just a comedy match.
What are you going to do with this? I don't care if it was Ricky Steamboat in here. And Jamie Noble, I think, a great kind of ring general in there. Probably the best guy to try and work this match with a woman. But you definitely have your hands tied.
Yeah, and nothing good ever really comes of a man versus woman match. Other than, you know, maybe a few laughs. And I suppose this might have gotten
sure,
a few
four
laughs.
And a half minutes. It's like, whatever. They recap SmackDown, where Kurt Angle was laid out in the back, and then he returned later in the show to attack John Cena and Big Show with a chair, who he assumed had attacked him, because they have a three-way tonight. And Kurt Angle's with Josh Matthews. Josh Matthews, man, a lot of tough enough on this show. Didn't even notice this when I was watching. Josh Matthews was wearing the most ungodly-looking turtleneck sweater.
I didn't notice.
It's like he was hiding a hickey.
Hmm.
He had, like, the frosted tips as well, and his glasses.
Well, that's the look for a backstage interviewer.
In 2004.
It's part of the uniform.
Angle justifies his attack and says, common sense says it was either John Cena or Big Show. So in this attack, Kurt Angle had no glimpse of who attacked him.
You ever been attacked?
I haven't, so...
Backstage?
Guess maybe he was just attacked from behind and was just out cold immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Cena walks in, does his rap delivery, and says he'll go to WrestleMania. And if he has a problem with Kurt Angle, he says, I come to you and say it to your face. And they end with a brawl, and they're separated by security, and Cena yelling, what? I've said it before. This John Cena rap character doesn't age well. I find this character so lame, and I liked it when it happened back in 2003 and 4. It's terrible watching today.
Because he was a heel. It works as a heel, because he's ridiculous.
He was a babyface here.
Yeah, because he got over so much as a heel. It turned him babyface. So he had to keep it for at least a little bit.
Well, I don't know. Even, like, we've watched some shows where he's still the heel. I mean, it was... It served its purpose for the time, which is what You should be booking. You shouldn't be booking characters that will resonate 10 years from now. They should be working for the time period. And this character did work at the time.
No, nobody books for characters that'll work 10 years down the line.
I know, but we're watching this in 2012. And this was an annoying John Cena.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe he should have went the full gimmick. Maybe he should have been called.
It's just funny watching this John Cena versus like today's be a star, totally. Rise above hate John Cena.
Absolutely.
Next up, we get a recap of Shelton Benjamin and JBL from SmackDown. This was prior to JBL. This was him as simply Bradshaw, the beer drinking APA member.
But by this point, he was already clean shaven and blonde.
That's true. Yes, he had cut his hair. And the match on SmackDown featured Shelton attacking his arm and then applying a Fujiwara armbar. And then in the same match, Bradshaw, selling the arm, comes back and wins the match. Not only winning the match, winning it with the clothesline from hell with his bad arm.
Did he sell the arm, though, afterwards?
He was selling it afterwards, okay. But...
Oh, sacrifice. Self-sacrifice.
All right. Cole asks if promoter Roy Shire ever envisioned an event like No Way Out.
Yeah, Cole was laying the history thick on this show.
Probably Jim Ross in his ear.
Maybe.
Who? Roy Shire?
What was
the fuck is that?
What was that name he butchered?
Stan Henson.
Yes, that's it.
So we get World's Greatest Tag Team, Charlie Haas and Shelton Benjamin taking on the APA, and Bradshaw's right arm is taped up. And Cole calls this a classic Strikers versus Grapplers affair.
What?
He's called the Strikers versus Grapplers.
Who are the Strikers here?
The APA.
Oh, I guess
they punch.
They're regular Anderson Silvas.
Yes, and we've got the Grapplers, Shelton Benjamin and Charlie Haas.
Okay.
So we get an APA chant at the start of this match. APA has the advantage, beating down Haas. And then they come back, attacking the left arm of Farouk, and are making frequent tags and keeping them in the corner. Bradshaw's in with Benjamin, Farouk, and Haas fight on the floor. Bradshaw hits his last call fall-away slam to Shelton off of the second turnbuckle. Then Haas comes into the ring, misses Bradshaw in the corner, and then takes a clothesline from hell, again with the bad arm, and he starts selling the bad arm.
Yeah.
But this leads to a super kick from Shelton Benjamin, and Benjamin pins Bradshaw 7 minutes and 22 seconds.
The super kick was on the injured arm as he was selling it, so I didn't have a problem with him doing the clothesline. He played perfectly into the finish. I thought this was, you know, a pretty short match, but pretty well-executed one that told a simple story. And I love the World's Greatest Tag Team. I can't remember the last time in the WWE I've seen a tag team cooperatively work on a body part in a tag team match. I don't remember. Seems like tag team matches, well, whenever they happen these days, they just come in, build, and then that's it.
What was interesting here, and this kind of goes to what we were talking about with Brock Lesnar, and obviously booking far out, I'm sure they had plenty of plans for Lesnar coming out of WrestleMania and what they would do with him. But JBL was a direct reaction to losing Brock Lesnar and needing a top heel. And they were forced to just create somebody. And just watching this, I mean, Shelton Benjamin pinning Bradshaw, they clearly had no plans with Bradshaw of that level at this point. I mean, there's no way this guy would have been just losing clean here had they had these giant plans for him to be headlining SmackDown after Mania.
In fact, I would say they almost seemed like they were giving Bradshaw a babyface push here. The way with, you know, Bradshaw was even playing to the crowd. He seemed like a big-time babyface. But, yeah, that coupled with Ron Simmons' retirement, I'm sure, led to that decision. And what a blessing in disguise.
Bill Goldberg then walks out to his seat wearing a Santa sleigh shirt.
Yes, that's right.
What a he came out and unzipped his coat to reveal the Santa's sleigh shirt. Like he snuck this shirt onto the pay-per-view.
Did the movie just come out, or did it?
No, I think he was filming it at this point. Oh, I don't think it came out till later.
It wouldn't have. This was February, so it probably wouldn't have come out until December or November.
Santa's sleigh. You can go catch that review, everyone. It's a Bill Goldberg just creating options for himself outside of wrestling.
Sure.
He actually wasn't bad in that. I enjoyed him in that
movie.
It
was fine. It was a fun, campy movie.
He goes to the front row and just puts his arm around some random kid sitting next to him.
Yes. Or this kid probably went up to him and started giving him a hug. It was nice. It was sweet.
So we get a video recap of Goldberg and Lesnar's feud, building from the Rumble onwards, including an F5 to Goldberg in the Rumble match that led to Goldberg being eliminated. And Goldberg would spear Paul Heyman on Raw, and that was the heat for this. So Paul Heyman comes out after this video airs, selling the spear from that past Monday, and says Goldberg will only witness a SmackDown pay-per-view, and if he gets up, he will have security escort him out and arrested. And he cuts his angry promo as Brock Lesnar then comes out, and Heyman says, "We have a saying on SmackDown. It's called, Here Comes the Pain." And Lesnar challenges Goldberg to come, but Heyman cuts him off and says, "No." And the two go back and forth yelling at Goldberg, and Lesnar says to sit down and be the bitch that you are. And this prompts Goldberg to hop over the ring and say, "I'm no bitch." And Heyman is distracted. Lesnar attacks Goldberg, goes for the F5, but Goldberg counters, hits the jackhammer as Heyman yells for security, and Goldberg is taken out without a problem, handcuffed, and escorted out by security.
As well as his theme song. Huh? A guy gets arrested, interferes in your show. He gets escorted by the police, and the music person decides to play his music. It's a little detail, but it kind of ruins it for me.
He was escorted out of the building by security.
Sure.
Just remember that. Lesnar is getting back up, and Hardcore Holly runs out. But he can't get to Lesnar, and they say how Hardcore Holly hates Brock Lesnar for breaking his neck. And they actually had just come off their Royal Rumble match. One of the most, weird WWE title matches in Royal Rumble history. I know the Rumble is typically the draw and you can put whatever, and this was the evidence of that. Mm. Brock Lesnar against Hardcore Holly for the WWE title.
Yeah, unfortunately. I mean, Holly's just one of those guys that I don't know if you can ever put him in a main event slot and have it be believable.
How about a mid-card spot with Rhino, which is what this led to, with Rhino coming out?
This match was made on Sunday Night Heat.
Oh, lots of time then.
Tons, yes.
They start fighting on the ramp. Holly tosses him into the ring. And, yeah, this is where they said, "This issue started 3 nights ago and was made on Heat."
Yeah, filler.
Oh, nothing says a grudge match here than an immediate side headlock by Hardcore Holly. Rhino gets the heat with a shoulder block to the gut into the corner, and then a leg scissors by Rhino. Holly moves into his closed guard, but Rhino lets go. Works on Holly's midsection, where they play up that he's setting up for the gore, and Holly cuts him off with a clothesline. Cole and Taz, during this match, throw to the Spanish announce team for a few seconds to call the action.
What was the point of this?
Maybe they were trying for more of a Spanish feel here with Eddie? I have no clue. I have no clue what this
was. The whole point of this, I personally didn't see a point because they just cut, they talk in Spanish and then they cut back to Cole and Taz.
With Taz saying, "I agree."
And Cole basically saying, "Look at these idiots speaking their gibberish." That's the whole point of these segments. What was that?
Carlos and Hugo.
They don't know English. Ha ha ha.
Holly hits a running drop kick to the top, and then he stopped. Rhino hits a superplex, gets a two count. Rhino hits a spine buster, hits the gore, but Holly rolls to the floor, and they suspect he has broken ribs. And I thought this was going to be a count out finish, but Hardcore Holly makes it back at 9. Pins were dropping here in the crowd. They were so excited. And all of a sudden, he's selling, and he hits his finish. The Alabama Slam at 9:56 out of nowhere and pins Rhino. Holly had zero sympathy as a babyface selling for this entire match, and the surprise finish didn't mean a thing to the audience.
No, I didn't get it at all.
This match sucked.
Anticlimactic. I mean, I thought it was okay. I thought Rhino, I thought they did a good job building, you know, the attacking the midsection and the gore and whatnot, but there was no heat to it at all. There were no stakes in this match, and the finish was flat. filler.
I was bored. We air a promo for the Monday Night War DVD and a promotion they were doing for SmackDown called Smack Your TV.
Okay.
Smack Your TV.
Yeah, what was that?
For SmackDown, to watch SmackDown. And it featured Vince interacting with employees and slamming a laptop shut on an employee's hands.
Okay, I missed that. I didn't get that.
Maybe they should have combined their promotional efforts and had Tori and Sable saying, "We'll do anything." So smack your TV.
We want you to enjoy the show so you can enjoy us.
Enjoy us. They showed Viz of Alcatraz, which Jim Ross mentioned on Twitter last week was an idea he pitched for The Undertaker and Mankind to have a match on Alcatraz.
Really?
Yeah. He said, "We had it cleared to do it, but maybe not one of my better ideas."
Yeah. What would it have entailed?
Like
what?
Two guys fighting on this island.
With inmates running around, cheering them?
Well, there aren't inmates there anymore. It's just an
Isn't
island.
Isn't it still a prison?
Is it still a prison?
I would think so. What else would be
well,
the
Well, then,
point?
Yeah, have prisons as lumberjacks.
Great idea.
Loser swims back. Nick Diaz has done that. He swum from the land to Alcatraz like four times.
Oh,
apparently
really?
It's some crazy feat to pull off.
Before somebody gets on my case, let us just get our facts right about Alcatraz.
One of us is wrong. Probably be me.
Oh, boy. Alcatraz Island. Here we go. Oh, there are official tickets. You can go to Alcatraz. So.
I'm glad. I'm guessing there's not too many dangerous offenders
All
on
right,
an island.
All right, well, let me see
is
this.
Is a tourist spot.
Let me see this. Okay. Often referred to as The Rock, the small island was developed with facilities for a lighthouse, a military fortification, a military prison, and a Federal Bureau of Prisons federal prison until 1963. Beginning in 1969, the island was occupied for more than 19 months by a group of American Indians from San Francisco who were part of a wave of Indian activism across the nation. Blah, 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 blah. In 1972, Alcatraz became a national recreation area and received designation as a historical landmark in 1966. Today, the island's facilities are operated by the National Park Service as part of the Golden Gate, such and such. Oh, okay, I guess not. I watch too many movies.
There's a video on Rey Mysterio and Chavo Guerrero's feud, including the heel turn by Chavo on Eddie and pairing him with his dad, Chavo Classic. And then the angle with Eddie where he is laid out in the washroom and Mysterio stares down the Chavos in the washroom, suspecting they attacked him.
You just don't know. You get attacked, you lose all memory. You don't
Identical
know.
Layout spots on the same show. Mysterio has the boxer Jorge Paez in his corner, who did some vocals on his WWE Originals track, which was the theme song for this pay-per-view.
Crossing Borders.
Crossing Borders.
Which we have also reviewed in a previous review.
That's away. A fun review.
Yeah.
The WWE Originals CD.
Mm-hmm. I wish they did more of those. I mean, I know there's not too much money in music sale these sales.
Do
these
them
days.
As like iTunes singles.
I think that's great.
I think
TNA should do them. Like a company that could, you know, use
like the they always plug, you know, the theme music is available on iTunes. Are you really going out of your way to get Alex Riley's theme music? Do something clever. Like
Alex Riley's theme music hit on Sunday, and I couldn't tell it apart from any other theme song.
Paez, former WBO and IBF featherweight champion, and his last fight was in December of 2003. And then, yes, was in the video with Mysterio. So I didn't really understand this crossover.
Well,
Jorge
no.
Paez was...
It seems like they're going... they're striving for that Hispanic demographic hard with this episode and SmackDown in general.
I'm not Hispanic, so I don't know how popular Paez was. But to me, it doesn't stand out as one of a crossover star
if you are
the boxing.
If you are a member of the Hispanic community, and if you are at all a boxing fan, please let us know. And let us know about Alcatraz as well.
This part was great. Chavo's coming out, but before we get a video interruption where it says, "In 28 days, the dead will rise," and we come back, and Michael Cole says, "If my math is correct, WrestleMania is in 28 days.
Hmm.
Subtle that, Michael Cole. So, The Undertaker. An ominous video promoting Undertaker's return. Seems to be the formula every year. So then we go to Rey Mysterio, accompanied by Jorge Paez, against Chavo Guerrero, along with Chavo Sr., for the Cruiserweight title. And right in the front row, there was a sign that read, R.D. Reynolds Rules, from WrestleCrap. Once again, Jimmy Corderas, the official for this one. Jorge Paez was wearing this neon orange shirt with a neon orange jacket. With this goofed haircut.
Hey, I don't know. I don't know. It's his look.
Maybe it's
you gotta stand out.
He's neon like, orange.
Yeah.
There were a lot of neon signs on this show in terms of bodies. This was pre-wellness policy, this show.
Oh, yeah.
And man, were there some bodies on this show that were, wow.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
Early on, Chavo goes for the mask of Rey. Rey sends him to the floor in response and returns to the ring, starts working on the right arm of Rey. Mysterio goes for a leaping sunset flip that Chavo avoids, but then runs into the ropes, takes a 619, but Chavo Sr. trips up Rey, and this leads to Paez coming over and knocking out Chavo Classic as Cole yells, "Down goes Sr." Oh, this guy is so lame. Oh, doing Howard Cosell on the show.
Ugh. Well, I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. He was throwing a line out there.
Yeah, whatever.
What's the problem? I thought Paez's punch looked good. He even did like a cartoonish wind-up before throwing the punch. And he played his role well. Afterwards, arguing with referee Jimmy Corderas.
Who threw Paez to the back.
Mm-hmm.
Corderas said, "Don't mess with me, Paez." And Paez left. Chavo is checking on his dad, then takes a springboard cross body by Rey to the floor, and then a springboard leg drop by Rey into the ring for a near fall, as Cole and Taz yell, "He dropped the dime! He dropped the dime!"
That's the name of the finisher.
That's a springboard leg drop.
That's the name of the finisher.
He dropped the dime. Chavo is seated on the top, and Rey climbs up, but ends up taking a gut buster from the second turnbuckle, and then Chavo... worked over the ribs of Rey with an abdominal stretch. Chavo applied a single leg lion tamer, kind of like the Brock lock at the time. But Rey would kick him off. Rey sends Chavo into the post. They go back and forth. Rey hits like Jeff Jarrett's stroke for a near fall and then a DDT to the outside apron. Rey misses a reverse cross off the top rope. Chavo places him on top, goes for the mask again, gets knocked down. Takes out Chavo with a moonsault, but Chavo gets his foot on the ropes. And then finish here comes with Rey climbing to the top rope, but the ref's back was turned. And Chavo Classic pushes Rey off the top rope, and he kind of guillotines himself on the top rope. And Chavo rolls up Rey, hooks the tights, and gets the win. 17 minutes and 23 seconds.
How long?
17 minutes and 23 seconds.
Yeah, that's right.
I got a lot of time.
I thought this was an awesome, awesome match between these two. They were given a lot of time, and it was an incredibly fast pace throughout the entire thing. Great execution of all their spots.
They used Pai as well. I thought the one spot, and then he was not a focus afterwards. They got rid of him.
Yep, and the crowd reaction was fantastic. I even liked Cole and Taz here. You might disagree with me, John, but when... matches are great and full of action. I thought this era of Cole and Taz were at their best at just calling action.
The Chavos are in the back, Senior and Junior, with Josh Matthews, who interviews him. Chavo says he beat all the odds out there. And he points to this locker room behind him with the word Eddie on the door. And he calls Eddie a loser because he's an addict.
Yeah.
And there's a monkey on his back. And that causes him to be a loser. And you know what losers win? Nothing, because they are losers.
Mm-hmm.
This was a great promo from Chavo.
This was awesome, and it just brought back shades of Owen Hart's classic promo from Survivor.
Identical reference I was going to make.
Survivor Series 1994, Owen saying, "You're a loser," to his older sibling, Brett. Very much a similar tone with this type of feud, and I really enjoyed it almost just as much. I thought Chavo and Chavo Sr. as a pair are always fantastic, and Chavo doing a great job here.
This, to me, was the height of Chavo. He kind of disintegrated into comedy after a couple of years and all the Hornswoggle stuff, and I really... He became really an annoying character to me, but at this point, man, his promos were underrated, I think. I think he was always somewhat underrated. He wasn't at that level of, you know, Eddie in the ring or Ray with the lucha style, because he never really worked in Mexico. But this period of time, I thought Chavo was really great, and this promo, I just loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what losers win? Nothing, because they are losers.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Then they preview the three-way coming up with Kurt Angle, Big Show, and John Cena. And they did the matchup board where they had the career highlights. And
yes.
Angle has his Olympic gold medal win. Big Show, former champion. John Cena, PhD in thugonomics.
That's just as...
That's his accomplishment.
That's just as worthwhile as a three-time WWE championship.
So Cena comes out, gets a babyface reaction, and then cuts his rap promo... But it doesn't rhyme. And he ends it with...
No, it rhymed.
Are you sure?
Parts of it. His rhymes have never been, you know... They
He at least did the most basic...
They're poems.
...of just the last words connecting.
They rhyme.
It ended with, "Hang by my words, and they can swing from his balls."
No, they rhymed. I mean, that line itself didn't rhyme, but it rhymed with another line beforehand, I'm sure.
All right. I didn't rewind and listen back to this, but whatever. It was John Cena.
It was John Cena doing what got him over in the first place, and that was his R-rated poetry.
R-rated?
R-rated. Absolutely.
Balls?
Balls. Yeah, you don't hear that these days. He's also wearing a San Francisco baseball jersey.
Yep. Milking it here.
Milking it, yep.
Angle and Cena take turns with Big Show. I found Cena really annoying. As much as people might get on him for his wrestling, it is... I won't even say good right now. It's, you know, if he's in with the right guy, the match connects really well today.
Yeah.
He was terrible back here. He really stuck out for me in here. Maybe it's because he was working with Kurt Angle, but I just found John Cena was just... I don't know, man.
I would say John Cena's a fine wrestler today. I mean, I don't mean fine in his execution of moves or not that, but I think his timing is excellent. I think when he's able to, you know, get in there with somebody who can deliver a lot of the great moves, I think his timing is fine, and he can be carried to a good match. I thought the weak link here in this match was the Big Show, who was a lot fatter and a lot slower back then, and the match would always grind to a halt whenever he was in.
Cena gets knocked off the apron and is selling his knee, and he had a knee brace on here. I think he legit injured this in the Rumble match, so was selling a legit knee injury at the time. Cena and Show work in the ring. Angle was on the apron and almost takes a choke slam, but then gets behind Big Show and did his spot where he teases a German suplex to Big Show off of the apron to the announce table. I love this spot because he never did it. And it was just a great spot for the crowd to go nuts at the chance of it happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then AJ Styles and Petey Williams thought, let's do the spot. Dude, that's a steel guardrail. Yeah. I'll take it. And no one remembers it. No one remembers it.
I don't remember it.
But you probably always remember these teases that Angle would do here. I love this spot. You tease danger, but you don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it. Angle hits consecutive German suplexes to Cena. Big Show breaks the cover and then tosses Angle shoulder first into the post and to the floor. And that left Cena and Big Show in to work for a few minutes. We saw John Cena hit a drop kick to the shin, and he pumped up. He wore pumps at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So he would bend over and pump up. And then he later went to the top, hit an axe handle. Angle misses a missile drop kick to drop Big Show. Then Angle gets tossed. John Cena hits the FU to Big Show. Cena then counters an Angle slam and hits a DDT, but misses Angle, who goes to the floor. Then we see an Angle slam to Big Show for a two count. Cena comes back into the ring, and his FU is countered with an ankle lock by Angle. Then Angle gets choke slammed. Cena rolls up Big Show for a two count. Then Cena hits the five-knuckle shuffle. His knee is clipped as he's going for the FU to Kurt Angle by Big Show, and then tosses Cena into the turnbuckle.
Knee first.
Yeah, and then landed upside down.
Mm-hmm. That's when I like the Big Show the best, is when he does like physical feats that no one else can. And it's sometimes it's as simple as tossing John Cena upside down, knee first, into a turnbuckle.
Angle then took Big Show out of the match by delivering an angle slam, sending Big Show over the top rope to the floor. And then Angle's knee gets clipped, but he gets into a heel hook, and John Cena taps out at 12 minutes, 19 seconds. So Kurt Angle wins the match and has the title shot at WrestleMania.
This was like a leg bar, ankle lock combination playing on the injured knee of Cena. And I thought this was a good match. Cena got a good babyface rub despite the loss. They're giving this guy the slow burn and not rushing him with wins and catapulting him to the top. He's taking losses, but at the same time, he's gaining a lot of, you know, story from all this.
I thought Kurt Angle was the MVP of this match.
Mm-hmm.
And a much bigger Kurt Angle.
For me, like, it's really interesting to see John Cena at this stage as an upcoming, fresh, lower main card talent compared to how overexposed he is today. Like back then, he was only receiving applause. Everybody liked him. Everybody wanted him to turn babyface. Today, we're sick of him. We're sick of the gimmick.
They aired another promo for the original CD, another promo for WrestleMania, and then a video preview of Eddie Guerrero winning the SmackDown Rumble and highlights of his go-home promo, which we put up on the Review Away Facebook group. As I mentioned last week when we were talking about doing this show, this go-home promo was just awesome. Mm. Both guys were fantastic, I thought, and Eddie Guerrero, it was just such a great promo. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching it where it's like, that is the goal of a go-home show, where you cannot wait to see this match. Both guys are compelling characters, and you're excited that when this match was made, no one thought it was anything more than a transition pay-per-view and Brock was going to win and go into Mania. Mm. And Eddie Guerrero had been gaining steam significantly for a couple of months here. I mean, internally in the WWE, they were comparing him to, like, this could be our Hispanic version of Steve Austin. Mm-hmm. And they were really starting to get a lot of momentum behind Eddie, and it kind of culminated here at No Way Out. But just if you haven't seen that promo, just simply Google or YouTube Eddie Guerrero, Brock Lesnar, February 12th, 2004. And the whole segment comes up, and it's awesome.
This is a promo where Eddie basically talks about, you know, his addictions in the past, about how he embarrassed his race, he embarrassed his family. And Brock calls him out on it, saying he's an addict. And Eddie says, yeah, I'm an addict. I'm addicted to winning and the adulation of the fans. A fantastic promo. And it just shows why Eddie Guerrero was such a great pro wrestler, because he's not somebody who just delivers it inside the ring, but his promo skill was almost as good as his in-ring ability.
His promos really are what saved him in the WWE, because, you know, he was brought in and, you know, he was considered a good worker, but really wasn't going to get past a certain level. And to me, the turning point was when they put him with China and how entertaining he made those segments. Sure. And it was like, this guy was an unbelievable personality.
Mm-hmm.
Great promo skills. And this was kind of the height of it, where his character really started clicking and connecting. Mm-hmm. And after this, you'd get his program with Rey Mysterio the following year. Just fantastic, where it was unfortunate as his personality clicked at that highest level, it's when his body really started breaking down from the style he had worked. Mm-hmm. And that last year was really tough for him with his back problems, and but just a fantastic all-around performer at this point.
Yep.
So we go to the main event, Brock Lesnar and Eddie Guerrero for the WWE title in San Francisco.
You know, the vibe of this match to start, Cole here was very much talking, building up the story of Eddie here, saying how, you know, Eddie was fired, and really building setting up this match, almost telegraphing that, you know, here's a story of a man trying to triumph over his demons, and this is his chance, almost telegraphing the win. Like, I got the same vibe here at the beginning of this match as I did as a kid watching WrestleMania 12 with Michaels going in against Bret, where, like, even as a kid, even before, like, I found out wrestling was fake and everything, I just got the sense, man, this guy, not even the champion, coming down a fucking zip line. How is this guy going to lose? And I just kind of got that same vibe here with Eddie, you know, clearly seeming like he's going to get the win. But I think it's fine, you know?
You know what? I got that same thing watching this, but I can tell you, at the time, I don't think anybody thought they would put the title on Eddie Guerrero.
Wow, is that right? Even as you were watching the show?
Even, it looks plain as day. Like, the finish of this match is obvious, like, the way they're building it up.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? At the time, it was like, I mean, look at the pedigree of champions here. Like, yes, you have your Bretts and Shawns that everyone points to, but I mean, look at that time period. I mean, you had, like, Austin and Rock and Hunter and Brock, even. And Eddie Guerrero was just, he was always considered, you know, your solid worker that just was never going to be a top guy in the WWE. Benoit was kind of painted with the same brush.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was really a big deal at the time. And how funny is it that you look at this, like, Eddie and Benoit, the thing everyone points to is just, man, these guys were so small. I mean, look at these two at the time. Like, huge.
Huge, but still huge, small in comparison to
Brock Lesnar, but Undertaker. I mean, look at what they put onto their frame. I mean, those two bodies were, their frames were not built for the weight these guys were carrying.
Well, absolutely, and you can always, always make the argument and ask that, would these guys be put in the position that they were put in if they didn't have those physiques?
I don't know, man.
I don't know.
I don't think they would.
I don't know if they would either. I mean, if without any substance, I would imagine Eddie, you know, with a similar physique to somebody like Chavo, for instance. And it's hard to say because, like, you know, a guy with like Eddie Guerrero with so much talent in so many other areas, maybe it would have been fine. Like, look at Rey Mysterio, for instance, or even, you know, a guy like CM Punk right now. So it's hard to say. It's very hard to say.
Match begins. Brock Lesnar just looked insane.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing how, like a body for wrestling and a body for MMA are going to be completely different
because
they're achieving very different goals.
Mm-hmm.
But for a guy that, in MMA, you're at home. You can train every day at home. You can eat well. You can... I'm just saying, it was a... Must have worked hard when he was in the WWE.
Oh, come on. But at the same time, John, like, we it's not like... It's not like
Dude, this guy looked ridiculous.
I know.
Are you going to defend this body?
I'm not defending it, but I'm not saying it's completely plain as day, as you might be making it to seem. I mean, I don't know much about, you know, nutrition and bodybuilding and whatnot, but I know it... There are certain things that you are doing to strive for one look as opposed to functionality that you might require in MMA. And I don't think we should get into this.
All right. I don't want to make this like a downer or anything like that.
Oh, it's not a downer. I just don't think... Anyway. I don't want to make any allegations is all.
I'm not making any allegations. I'm just saying.
Okay.
It's very tough to look like that. So, good on him.
I just wouldn't make those comparisons because the training, I'm sure, is very different for MMA and pro wrestling.
It is completely completely different training.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy, at this point, was over 300 pounds of jacked muscle.
Yeah.
I would be shocked at what his level of body fat was at this time.
No.
And Brock Lesnar in the UFC was by no means in bad condition at all.
No. But he's training more for strength, more for endurance, more for cardio.
So let's get into this match. Guerrero goes for a Hurricane Rana off the ropes, and his this looked bad. He was almost dropped on his neck here as he was trying to deliver this Hurricane Rana right at the beginning, and basically got spun around by Lesnar.
I don't know what really happened. It almost looked like Eddie was coming off the top rope with the Rana and then expecting to be caught and powerbombed by Lesnar, while Lesnar was expecting something different. But this match could have turned out very differently.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the story of this match. I mean, Eddie Guerrero just played the underdog, selling for this monster, and just trying to find a way to ground the monster. And even the spot where he finally got Lesnar down, and he tried to pull his leg to the steel post. It was this struggle just to get the leg around the post. I really just enjoyed that versus just... I think a lot of the time... People will watch matches, and it's just we've watched so much stuff that it's just, a sequence occurs, and it's fluid, and it happens. And then when you see something like this, this struggle, it really stands out.
Well, those are the nuances of a match, isn't it? Because how many matches do we see where, you know, this match, it told a very basic story. It was a monster versus a little guy, and how the little guy is able to equalize the size and strength of the monster is through his speed and through his technique with his high flying and his submission skill. It was a very basic story, but it was told very well.
It can be difficult to do at times.
And as you mentioned, like, you know, showing the little struggles, even with Eddie trying to struggle to injure Brock's knee, those are the little nuances that separate the great wrestlers from, you know, maybe the average ones.
So he got him down, got the leg around the steel post. Guerrero applied an STF as they get into the ring.
And I love that. Like, this is Eddie Guerrero, who's not known for... this STF move is not identified with Eddie Guerrero at all, but he pulls it out because it makes sense for the psychology of the match, focusing on Lesnar's knee. It adds versatility and depth to the character.
And the crowd was popping for the submission tease here. And the crowd certainly wanted to see Guerrero win this, but I think everyone was just... They really played it up that Brock Lesnar was... This was just simply a transition because you also had this Goldberg program thrown in everyone's face.
Mm-hmm.
And on the surface, I mean, the average fan in the crowd doesn't know contract situations. They're thinking Lesnar Goldberg for the title at WrestleMania. That totally makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what a lot of people thought about this. Lesnar made a comeback after the STF spot with a belly-to-belly suplex. And then we got Goldberg chance. And Guerrero came back, tilt-a-whirl, leg scissors, and then a figure four leg lock. But Lesnar reaches the ropes. He applies a Texas cloverleaf and then goes back to the STF that Taz even refers to, the step-over toe-hold face lock.
I thought this was, again...
Cole and Taz, if I ragged on them earlier, I thought they were great in this match.
Absolutely. I thought this was, honestly, perhaps the best I've ever heard Michael Cole call a match. And this will probably come into play more in the finish, but I thought the two of them did a fantastic job. But, you know, we kind of skipped over this earlier, but when Brock... re-injures his knee. Here are the spots, okay? Because earlier in the knee, Eddie is selling. Lesnar hits this running knee into the turnbuckle, just like, you know, jumping straight with the knee right into Eddie. And Eddie is injured this whole time, but how Lesnar begins to sell the knee is by Lesnar attempting this running knee again. Eddie ducks it, and Lesnar hits his knee into the turnbuckle. The psychology behind the spot is perfect because Eddie took the spot once. Second time, he learns to avoid it, and it leads to him believably regaining the advantage against, you know, against Lesnar through the knee injury.
It was a really good spot where he goes over the top and then to the floor. After the second STF spot, Lesnar comes back with this just very fluid German suplex and then a spine buster. I mean, his offense just looked so good and just fit this story really, really well. Guerrero misses a drop kick off the top rope, and you can see Lesnar bleeding from the nose here. And I know in like hindsight that, you know, this is an awkward spot where Lesnar's just yelling die at Eddie, but I mean, it was...
Oh, I didn't even think of that.
Well, anyway,
I thought it was fun. Like, the visual of Lesnar's face...
It was a great, like, just heel spot here. I mean, Lesnar was just such a great heel.
And I know, like, you know, something like Lesnar's nose bleeding was probably completely unintentional, but it worked perfectly because here's the monster who, you know, looks basically... like he can't be stopped at the beginning of the match. Like, what is this underdog going to have to do to slay this monster? And by this point of the match, Lesnar is just frustrated, and you could tell there are wounds on this on the monster's face. And I thought he just did a great job, played the monster perfectly, and also showed later on in the match that he was struggling.
Guerrero hit the Three Amigos, which at the time were simply called three consecutive vertical suplexes, then misses the frog splash, and Lesnar goes for the F5, but in doing so, knocks out referee Brian Hebner with Guerrero's legs. And in the process, the crowd just stands up, just totally expecting a run-in.
Bill Goldberg.
Bill Goldberg, and Lesnar gets a visionary fall on Guerrero. Lesnar then comes out, grabs his title, but then Goldberg runs in. I don't know what happened to security or what happened to him after he was banned from rings, from the arena.
He was banned from...
It was a sports entertainment return.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
So Goldberg runs in, spears Lesnar to a gigantic reaction, and then just takes off.
A gigantic... Yes, yeah. And well, yeah, why does he have to stay? But, I mean, Goldberg received a gigantic reaction for this spear, but I felt like most of the reaction came from the fact that the audience, for once, believed that Eddie could actually be winning this title.
You can debate the necessity of having Goldberg in this match. I remember at the time I wasn't a big fan of it, but...
I thought it was fine. It built to Brock and Goldberg at Mania, and... I don't know. What's wrong with it?
I'm never a fan of the fluke win. And if this had just led to the finish, I think it would have been worse, but I think it played out fine. Guerrero gets on top, but Lesnar kicks out at two, and there was just a massive pop here. This was clear. The crowd was buying Eddie winning the title.
Like, I love hearing the disappointed ahs of a near fall almost as much as the pop in this is great for that. This Lesnar lifting his arm up at like 2.999 seconds. It was done perfectly.
So then Guerrero grabs the belt with the referee still out, goes to hit Lesnar, who ducks. The belt falls down. Lesnar goes for the F5, but Guerrero reverses in midair and hits a tornado DDT right by the title. He was, I guess, trying to land Lesnar right on the title. And then he climbs up for the frog splash, hits it, and gets the win. Gigantic reaction. This match went 30 minutes and 7 seconds. One of the longer main events in WWE pay-per-view history.
And I loved every second of it. I thought the booking of that finish was great. Because like when Eddie grabs the title, even though it's his gimmick, the crowd is kind of conflicted because, you know, he's the babyface. Nobody wants to see this guy win his first title by cheating. But the way they did it, they had Brock duck, and then Eddie basically... unintentionally counters the F5 into a DDT on the belt, so he's in essence cheating without really cheating. So he doesn't seem like a coward at all. He still lives with this gimmick, but it's not like he did it intentionally. So I thought it was great.
Eddie Guerrero runs into the crowd. Everyone's mobbing him as security comes to his rescue. And somewhere, a young Jose Aldo was watching that and thinking, one day I'm going to steal that. And Guerrero hugs his mom and his family in the crowd, which actually, 101 in wrestling booking. If the family's at ringside for their relative challenging for a title, probably going over.
Though Vicky wasn't there. Vicky and the kids weren't there.
That's true. That's true. They were not. But we did see Mondo there and his mom, who he hugged. And that's how the show went off the air. It was a gigantic reaction, and you really felt like there's title changes that we've talked about in the past where it's, you know, it's simply we're putting the title on you, but we're not going to get really behind you. With Eddie, they were definitely, you got the sense this was not going to be a transitional champion. This was someone they wanted to get behind, capitalize on this Hispanic audience. Yep. He's connecting at a big level and wasn't simply holding the belt for the next guy a month from there.
Yeah. For me, like watching a show like this, even knowing the result, it is just, it's a great moment in a man's life, a legitimate great moment in a man's life when he accomplishes a career and a life goal. So I watch this and I can't help but smile and get emotional because this is when wrestling feels real to me. It's still real to me, damn it. A great match, great booking of the spots, and Lesnar did a great job.
Lesnar was awesome.
I felt like by the end of his run in pro wrestling, he really understood, you know, first of all, mic work. He was a lot more comfortable, and also storytelling in the ring. So the guy was great. Cole and Taz were amazing as well. So to me, this is a classic main event.
So a great, great main event. Really, the last three matches, I thought, all pretty well delivered. I wasn't a big fan of the undercard at all. I thought this was like two separate shows almost.
Sure.
One was great, and one was like an extension of your regular weekly SmackDown show. Yeah. So I'm going to give this show a 7 out of 10, just because I do judge it as a whole. But just an awesome, awesome main event. And I remember after this pay-per-view, I knew I was going to WrestleMania the next month, and I was so pumped because it felt like this was something new. It was like, you know, the WWE had certainly hit a down period in 2002 and 3. And at the time, it's like this felt like something fresh and new. House shows actually went up after Eddie Guerrero won the title. And, I mean, we can talk about it further, but it was unfortunate with Eddie where he put so much pressure on himself in this highlighter role as the champion. And it really got to him, and it led to his run being shortened, which was unfortunate. But a great, great night here, and probably one of the moments people most associate when they think of Eddie Guerrero was this show.
Totally. I give it an 8.5 because I thought the last three matches were strong enough to warrant that. I mean, just for the main event alone, this show already gets a 7. But you couple that with a great Chavo and Rey match and a pretty decent three-way with Cena, Angle, and Big Show, and it gets an 8.5 out of me. Did you ever watch... You didn't watch a DVD, though, did you?
Of which? This?
Of this.
No, I didn't.
Because on the DVD, they actually had a bonus with Eddie's post-win victory celebration. So I watched this, and this was awesome. He goes to the back. He's hugging all the boys. He's kneeling, and he's praying, and just... Then he finally, like, the last segment is him getting on the phone, and it's Vicky on the other line. And all you don't really hear.
They aired this on TV.
Oh, they did.
I remember seeing this.
You don't really hear what Vicky's saying, but like you only hear Eddie talk, and like Eddie is just thanking Vicky, and then you can hear Vicky on the other line kind of say, "Thank me for what?" And then Eddie just starts like, you know, starts tearing up, and he starts just talking about how, you know, Vicky was always there to put up with all his addictions through the years, and God damn, this was like the greatest, you know, promo, one of the greatest, and it all felt very real, and it was really nice.
It was it was a time period, man, where like for fans that had watched for so long and had just kind of accepted that, you know, there were these great wrestlers that were in this spot, but they would never be at that level. And then at Mania, you had that closing moment, which unfortunately it will never be remembered the way it was then. But it was just, it felt like the WWE was catering to a different audience. They, you know, business was flat. Let's try this new direction. And that's what it felt like at that time.
Yeah.
So let's get into your feedback here. You can always leave feedback at reviewaway.com. We'll start off with Stephen Gutteridge. Shortly after No Way Out, I had the pleasure of meeting Eddie Guerrero in New York at WrestleMania weekend. He was an absolute gentleman and took a real interest in us that we'd traveled from England to see WrestleMania. I could never have realized a little over 18 months later he'd be gone. Nights like No Way Out 2004 are why we sit through hours after hours of nonsensical angles and poor TV, because occasionally pro wrestling produces magical moments that other sports and genres of entertainment struggle to match. This was historical, emotional, and incredible, all rolled into one. Eddie was a legend that was gone too soon, and its passing will always be a crushing reminder of the tragic and dark side of the industry that we all love.
Let's go to David Duvenberg. Even though the undercard wasn't all that bad, I never gave less of a shit about an undercard because I was so excited for the main event. I remember working in a bowling alley and convincing my boss to order the show so we can put it up on the big screen while I worked. Best night of work ever. Eddie winning the belt almost didn't seem real. The Goldberg run-in didn't even make the victory seem tainted either. The WWE wanted Eddie as their main man, and I thought it was executed perfectly. I gave the show an 8 out of 10 just because Eddie versus Brock absolutely delivered.
It really was. I mean, from a selling point of view, it was like a one-match show that
completely delivered. Alexander Rio, second to WrestleMania 20, this may have been my favorite pay-per-view of 2004. Eddie Guerrero cemented his legacy and bought a one-way ticket into the Hall of Fame on this night. Even if he were still alive and competing today, no doubt in my mind he was a first ballot shoe-in. Now, as much as I loved Eddie, there were other matches on this show. I remember Rikishi and Scotty Too Hotty tagging and living off the old Too Cool connection here against the pre-cabinet Bashams in what looked like something out of a BDSM show or the movie Barbed Wire. The triple threat cage match with Big Show, Kurt Angle, and John Cena. Obviously, this was a younger and edgier Cena, but did he not weigh less jacked compared to today? His neck today is like he swallowed a bowling ball in comparison. And, of course, the WWE Championship match with Eddie and Brock Lesnar. I knew it would be an epic match. I had doubts whether Eddie would actually win it, but looking back, I clued in that Brock was going to wrestle Goldberg at Mania 20, where they were both literally stunned out of the company. But when Eddie won, I totally marked out, and the in-crowd celebration was awesome. Just because, if nothing else, it made it feel real for me. I gave it an 8 out of 10.
Let's go to Jonathan Hancock. I can't remember getting this excited about a February pay-per-view. I knew that Eddie would be getting the strap due to circumstances. To lead into Angle at Mania and have Goldberg and Lesnar not have a title associated with it, as it didn't need it. Seeing his mother and brother in the front row crying and Eddie jump into the crowd was amazing, as I jumped up and down on my couch. I was 22 and marking out like a 12-year-old when Eddie hit the frog splash. Next month, my dad and I went to WrestleMania, and I met Eddie at the Hall of Fame and shook his hand and thanked him for all he had given to the sport, and he thanked me for being a fan. I even told him I was able to find an LWO shirt and that I wore it with pride. He laughed. As we posed for a picture, my dad had to change the batteries, and the WWE personnel told me to move on and that no one else could get pictures with Eddie. I told the lady there was no way I was going anywhere. I got the picture and later found out my dad recorded our conversation, and I have that few seconds of video of the day I met my hero. Knowing what Eddie went through in his career and personal life, I was so proud on that day to see him a champion, and a month later, with his best friend to close WrestleMania 20, Viva La Raza. And he posts a link to him meeting Eddie.
Oh, you can go check that out on our thread for No Way Out.
Yes.
Patrick Tony, you can really see the difference in John Cena from 2004 till now. Back then, he was more energetic in his promos and his moves. Look at the five-knuckle shuffle, for instance. Back in 2004, Cena used to juke and jive before he hit the move. Now he just calls for it and hits it without an energy, without any energy put in. Also, Cena had a lot less muscle mass, and he was more agile in the ring. Fast forward to 2012, Cena's become so bulky, he's less mobile in the ring. Overall, this was a fun pay-per-view. Cole and Taz were awesome on commentary. The WWE title match was one of the best David versus Goliath matches I've ever seen. Only nitpick I have is with certain moves being hit on the Big Show. In the triple threat match, both Angle and Cena hit their finishers on show. I feel if you're billing the guy as a 7-foot, 500-pound giant, no one but another giant should be able to lift him off the ground. DDTs and stunners are okay since there is no lifting involved. Andre was never picked up by anyone but Hogan. It made sense with Hogan because at that time he was the Superman of the company. What do you guys think?
Well, I think they're certainly about to portray John Cena as a Superman of the company.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big spot they would give Cena, and then at the next Mania, the next month, he beat Big Show. Show was never protected as a giant throughout his... I mean, I don't think it meant a lot when, you know...
I kind of could understand the complaint about Angle, hitting the Angle Slam, but you don't want everybody to be able to lift the guy up. So I see what he's saying, but, you know, as we saw with what they would do with Cena, he's definitely a Superman. David C. Warden, I remember at the time hating these split-brand pay-per-views, but looking back, you can see that it at least allowed for stronger builds of main events, such as this one where Eddie was given at least a bit of time to grow into a main event challenger. The card was pretty weak, though, overall in the show, and you can see they were already struggling to make their mid-card meaningful to the audience, a problem I would say they still have to this day. The main event was superbly built and drew money too, a simple story based largely in reality, delivered by two great performers. While Eddie rightly takes a ton of credit, I have to say Brock was absolutely incredible, not only as an athlete, but also as a truly believable monster badass. What I loved about him was his scarily realistic offense and his taking a beating looked realistic too. When most monsters start getting beaten down by a smaller guy, it just looks stupid and fake. But Lesnar sold it like a veteran. He might have been getting bored out of the travel, but he was really growing as a performer. The WWE missed him, and I would argue the WWE has missed him I would argue, as much as anyone since 04. 9 out of 10.
Let's go to Jason Perez. I attended No Way Out with my dad, uncle, and two cousins. It was the best WWE event I've ever attended so far. The crowd was so hot for Eddie. I remember when he hit that frog splash and got the 3 count, the Cow Palace erupted. Everyone was so happy, high-fiving each other. It was a real special moment, and it's moments like that where I feel proud to be a wrestling fan. John Cena cut a good promo and was actually entertaining and not annoying like he is now. All the other matches had good in-ring work. The Cow Palace is known for having historic matches, and for Eddie Guerrero to win the WWE title, they're just added to that history. I'm honored and thankful to have been there with my family to witness that. Rest in peace, Latino Heat. I've been listening to you guys for almost a year now and enjoy your podcast. Well, thank you, Jason.
Kerry Heiskanen. I'm probably in the minority, but No Way Out was usually one of my favorite pay-per-views. SmackDown was the shit back then. I never missed an episode. I know a lot of people look back at the Attitude Era as a high point, but to me the high point is SmackDown of this era. It was just filled with great talent and awesome matches. Now I can't even remember the last SmackDown I watched. Funny thing about the WWE in Finland is that SmackDown started airing somewhere near the end of the invasion angle. I was psyched to see wrestling on TV again, which I hadn't seen in years, only some WCW way back. After long months of rumors, they also decided to start showing Raw, blah, 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 blah. It talks about Katie Vick and saying, what the fuck is this? And if I could suggest a future review, how about One Night Stand 07? Didn't we do that?
One Night Stand 07?
Oh, no,
that was not an ECW one.
Okay, we might do it.
Brett Armstrong. Welp, here comes the pain. That's exactly what I thought when some of the matches on this show were announced. The Charisma Twins with Shaniqua versus Rikishi and Scotty. I believe I can quote Way and just say, Jesus, fuck. Wasn't the worst match ever, but that was too typical of these split-branded, oversaturated pay-per-views during this period. Matches that went way too long with talent that really shouldn't have had that much. Jamie Noble and Nydia was pretty stupid. Again, lasted way too long. It was 4 minutes. Come on. He's a talented guy, but I always liked his funny trailer park stuff. I love how even during the video montage, you could see Nydia go from a B to a double D in the span of a few months.
Yeah, she used clothesline, I bet.
He comments here on all of the matches. Let's just quickly go through here. Chavo and Ray, I'm not a huge fan of either, but I did like the era of Chavo with Chavo Classic. Didn't really understand why that freaky Jorge Paez was with Ray, but whatever. Triple threat match was okay. I'm usually not a fan of these, but it did the job setting up for Mania. The part that I was disappointed was giving up the FU on Big Show spot. They should have saved that for WrestleMania. I'll agree on that sense.
They already did it, though, at the Survivor Series prior.
Okay, so they just completely prostituted that spot.
Yeah.
As far as the main event goes, I think the result outshines the match. It was an okay match, but there were some blown spots. Like, it just seemed two guys didn't have a lot of in-ring chemistry. My biggest problem was the Goldberg involvement. Did they think giving Eddie the legit win would look bad? Did Brock not want the job? Did they really think that Goldberg had to involve himself further on the show to push the Mania match? In the end, we got an amazing moment, which kind of made the show worthwhile. A 6 out of 10.
Well, like I mentioned, I didn't have a problem with the Goldberg involvement. I mean, bottom line, led to something. It led to a more money-making, potential down the road. And I never have a problem with that. Kieran Roche, all I can say is that the main event was one of the best David versus Goliath matches I have ever seen. Eddie truly was fantastic, and that post-match celebration was first class. The rest of the card was only okay. With Brock now gone from the UFC, here's hoping that we'll see him come back and have a few more matches, as he was without a doubt my favorite wrestler when I first started wrestling. First started watching.
And finally, Richard Elzey here, who writes, No Way Out 2004 was a one-match show, not helped by the fact that the brand-exclusive pay-per-view format at that time was resulting in heavily diluted undercards. Eddie was red-hot during this period, and the post-match celebration only served to capitalize that. On that, 8 out of 10, purely for the feel-good ending. Hmm. So thank you, everybody, for your feedback on the No Way Out show from 2004. As always, you can go to reviewaway.com to leave your feedback. And looking ahead to next week, Way, I thought this was kind of the best of Eddie Guerrero. Hmm. And we're going to look at something that was maybe the polar opposite, and that was the No Way Out 2006 show featuring the very controversial Eddie Guerrero storyline.
Oh, boy.
But there is some good on this show, and we are going to be joined by a guest next week
former lead writer for SmackDown during this time period, Alex Greenfield, is going to join me in Wei. He has a brand new movie that's just come out through Amazon Studios, and we have the link up in our Sunday update from this past week, and you can just watch it for free. So Alex is going to join us because I always find it fun to watch a show and then go back and kind of see what was the internal stuff. And this time period was insane because you had that crazy storyline and you also had this thing with Rey Mysterio at the time, which was a very debated topic backstage of what they were going to do with Rey heading into WrestleMania that year. So I thought it'd be an interesting show to go look back on for No Wei Out 2006. And aside from that, busy week coming up. We've got shows pretty much every day this week. We had Review of Raw, which is up on the site right now, this show, obviously. And then Thursday, I'm going to have an interview up on the site with another former WWE writer, Court Bauer, chatting about many things, including the WWE Network, the UFC on Fox, the Rumble, lots of stuff to chat about with Court. Friday, we've got Review and Impact with myself, Wei, and Nate Milton. And then Saturday, we've got a UFC 143 post show. And wow. Sunday, The Law after the Super Bowl.
When do you sleep?
I just don't.
Quickly, before we go off the air, in case you missed it on Review of Raw, we want to thank all the people that participated in our Royal Rumble draft. Over 500 participants.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And congrats to the winners, Ernie, Ethan, Humberto, and Sajid.
Yes, we had a four-way tie. So I hope everyone agrees with our decision to just do a random draw for the prizes with the four winners that we did on Monday night.
Yes.
It's a four-way tie. I figured that was the easiest Wei to do it. No?
I think there should be a playoff or we...
A playoff?
Yeah.
How are we going to do a playoff?
Just like the Royal Rumble when... We're repeating our conversation, of course, for Monday.
Yes.
But just like the Rumble when Brett and Luger both touched... At the same time, you gotta have a tournament.
But they're all gonna get prizes, though, aren't they? We had four prizes.
So what did you say? You said you were gonna randomly pick.
No, I thought Monday what we did was we can randomly draw and match the winner with a prize.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant randomly draw one winner out of these four.
No. I figure they all won, so they should all get something.
Of course. Yeah, you mentioned we had this exact same conversation on Monday.
You forgot.
No, it's been 2 days. Wow.
God, where are you stuck on Monday morning?
Yeah, wow.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap us up, everyone. I hope you're not sick of my voice by the end of the week, but if you are, that's cool. just yell at me on Twitter. That's what people do. Wei, what do you want to go out with here?
I would like to go out with the theme song of No Wei Out 2004, Rey Mysterio featuring Jorge Paez, Crossing Borders.
1, 2, 3, 4. 619. Life is hard, man, la vida es dura. Gotta believe in yourself. No es chiste, es mi cultura. Si yo puedo con alma pura. Rey Mysterio con mensaje serio. De su televisión, straight to your stereo. Cada persona tiene sueños. In order to move ahead, you gotta cross the border. They must have thought I was just a little mocoso. And all them haters said, no eres talentoso. Mírame, yo soy misterioso. Un mexicano con talento ingenioso. Puedo hacer cosas you can't believe. Tú no sabes what I have up my sleeve. De verdad yo sé los diseños para realizar mis sueños. Tengo la cualidad de oro en la que move como fuerza de un toro. De la costa oeste, con poder de mente, represento a San Diego y Tijuana de frente. Life is hard, man, la vida es dura. Gotta believe in yourself sin duda. No es chiste, es mi cultura. Si yo puedo con alma pura. Rey Mysterio con mensaje serio. De su televisión, straight to your stereo. Cada persona tiene sueños. In order to move ahead, you gotta cross the board. I was born in Califa, soy americano, pero mi vida es 100% mexicana. I reminisce on my school days.
all kinds of borders, yo estaba listo.
Hey Ray, hey Ray,
tú eres pequeño, but I knew I could do it porque era mi sueño. I love Tijuana and I love San Diego,
but I had to go,
go,
hasta luego,
so I could show my skills, a mi gente, a mi raza. Nowadays everybody knows my name, ¿qué pasa?
Life is hard, man,
la vida es dura, gotta believe in yourself, sin duda,
no es chiste,
es mi cultura. Si yo puedo con alma pura, Rey Misterio con mensaje serio, de su televisión,
straight to your stereo.
Cada persona tiene sueños, in order to move ahead you gotta cross the border. I love Tijuana and I love San Diego, but I have to go, Mexico. Acapulco, Tijuana.